This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Good to be with you. Thanks for listening. This is Joel Hilliker. Mass protests are filling the streets of several countries around the world on several continents for several different reasons. But there are some fundamental similarities among these protests that enable us to draw some larger lessons. We're going to start today's show by talking about that. And we'll hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about horrific wildfires that are blazing through California right now. He'll give us a sense of the scale of the devastation and discuss a little recognized reason for why these disasters are hitting this state time after time. Also, elections in Germany this past weekend yielded some stunning results as extremist parties on both right and left scored a major victory in the German state of Thuringia. This makes it so that Chancellor Angela Merkel is no longer able to find enough seats in parliament to form a government with her current coalition. We're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Daniel DeSanto about what this means for Germany. We'll begin, though, by talking about how several nations in Asia and Europe and South America, the Caribbean, and the Middle East are being rocked by mass protests. The Washington Post says 2019 has become the year of the street protester. This is what it said in a October 27th report as hundreds of thousands marched in Hong Kong and Santiago, Lebanon and London. What has become a global explosion of people power was prompting panic among a host of governments and raising some interesting questions about how and why it was all happening. Of course, mass movements have created turmoil and even overthrown governments before. But as this article says, this year is exceptional for the sheer breadth and diversity of the unrest. Hong Kong, which has now had 20 consecutive weeks of mass protests, has had perhaps the most noted uprising. But the Middle East has seen demonstrations in Algeria, Sudan, Egypt, and Iraq, in addition to Lebanon. In Latin America, Chile's riots followed mass protests in Ecuador, Argentina, and Honduras. In Eastern Europe, Romania, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Serbia, and Georgia have been rocked. Vladimir Putin has had to contend with the largest street demonstrations in Russia since 2012, and the list goes on. This is quite an extraordinary moment, and this, even as you're seeing major political instability roiling in America and Britain as well. Crises that are undermining the ability of these nations to govern themselves. Here is from an AP report, October 26th. In Hong Kong, it was a complicated extradition dispute involving a murder suspect. In Beirut, in Lebanon, it was a proposed tax on the popular WhatsApp messenger service. In Chile, it was a 4-cent hike in subway fares. Recent weeks have seen mass protests and clashes erupt in far-flung places triggered by seemingly minor actions that each came to be seen as the final straw. The demonstrations are fueled by local grievances, but reflect worldwide frustration at growing inequality, corrupt elites, and broken promises. This article from AP continues, where past waves of protests like the 2011 Arab Spring or the rallies that accelerated the breakup of the Soviet Union took aim at dictatorships, the latest demonstrations are rattling elected governments. The unrest on three continents, coupled with the toxic dysfunction in Washington and London, raises fresh concerns over whether the liberal international order with free elections and free markets can still deliver on its promises. It's a very interesting statement, and it's a fair statement to make. In the big picture, many of the fundamental aspects of government and economics and society, the principles, the ideas, the institutions that have underpinned the way the world works for generations are being challenged. They're being denounced in many cases. In Lebanon, the people are protesting a corrupt government that is demanding austerity measures, even while it's failed to reliably supply basic services like electricity, water, trash collection, and it's still rewarding itself. It's still perpetuating its own power. In Iraq, financial mismanagement, widespread government corruption is making a lot of people very poor. And you have public services and infrastructure that are falling into ruin, and yet the government is bickering internally. They're squandering the nation's oil wealth. And in recent protests there, Iraqi security forces have been cracking down, killing nearly 200 Iraqis. In Hong Kong, these massive protests that have been going on since June, they were initially sparked by the city passing a bill that could put Hong Kong residents into China's judicial system. Well, based on the protest or in response to the protest, the authorities dropped that bill, but the protest didn't stop and they snowballed. Now the protesters are demanding greater autonomy. They want more democracy for the city. This AP report says underlying the Hong Kong protest movement are rising fears about China's tightening grip on the city and worries that Beijing is reneging on promises not to meddle with Hong Kong's Western-style civil liberties, such as freedom of speech and an independent judiciary. Protesters also fear China's technology-powered authoritarianism. So these are definitely legitimate concerns. In all these situations, there are real problems. And it is easy to sympathize with these people who are speaking out and they're trying to improve their living conditions and hold the government to account. In Spain, after years of peaceful protests by Catalan separatists, last week the movement turned violent. This AP report says protests erupted over the imprisonment of nine leaders who led a bid for independence from Spain in 2017. That failed attempt left the separatist movement rudderless, with 12 of its leaders arrested and most of the rest fleeing the country. New activist collectives have emerged in their place, including one calling itself the Tsunami Democratic, which uses its own app and encrypted messages to call for civil disobedience. Now, this is interesting. Here you have these demonstrators that are using technology in order to help them and in order to rally people to their cause. In one of these incidents, they besieged Barcelona's international airport. Rioters clashed with the police late into the night. This AP report says the group has borrowed some of its tactics and rhetoric from the Hong Kong protesters. And protesters in both places have staged demonstrations in support of one another. So it's an interesting linking up between these two geographically very separate places. This article continues, the fact that one movement is struggling against domination by one-party China, while the other is rising up against a European democracy, is a distinction that has been lost in the tear gas. So that's what's happening there in Spain. In South America, in Bolivia, there was an election on October 20th that awarded Evo Morales a fourth term, but the result was disputed. Violence erupted in several regions. On October 23rd, they launched a general strike. Clashes between supporters and opponents of Morales have injured several people. In Ecuador, the government scrapped fuel subsidies, and it sparked 12 days of protests. Just earlier this month, that killed eight people and injured 1,340 people. The president and the movement behind the demonstrations, they reached an agreement. The government reinstated fuel subsidies, so that was a success as far as the protesters were concerned. In Chile, protests have been growing over a subway fare increase and, more generally, economic inequalities, even though this is one of Latin America's wealthiest countries. The president responded to the protest by canceling the subway fare increase. He postponed an increase in electricity prices. He promised to raise the minimum wage and the minimum pension. The protests continued. Last Friday, an estimated 1.2 million Chileans took to the streets in Santiago, the capital. They burned dozens of the subway stations in the city, And in clashes with police, more than 7,000 people were arrested. Hundreds were injured. At least 19 have been killed. Chilean businesses have suffered more than $1.4 billion in losses. CityLab quoted one person who was protesting. People became tired of living in an uneven society. We have people making a lot of money, but the majority are profiting very little from the Chilean success. So this is in a country where the poverty rate has fallen over the past 30 years from almost 50% to just 6%. The Washington Post says living standards have risen dramatically and inequality is less severe than in all but two other Latin American countries. So that's it's all interesting. Every single one of these situations is a little bit different, but why is it all happening at the same time? There are a couple of factors in common in all of these situations. One of the most powerful is that they are virtually all being fueled by young people. Stephen Fleury spoke about this on his show Monday, this past Monday for a bit. But he quoted a Guardian article dated October 26th, about 41% of the global population are under 24 and they're angry. That is the title of this Guardian article. A spate of large-scale street protests around the world, from Chile to Hong Kong to Lebanon and Barcelona, is fueling a search for common denominators and collective causes. Are we entering a new age of global revolution? It says recent upheavals do appear to share one key factor: youth. In most cases, younger people are at the forefront of calls for change. Now, in one sense, this is the way it's always been with revolutions throughout history. But this article says, yet, while younger people in any era are predisposed to shake up the established order, extreme demographic, social, and political imbalances are intensifying present-day pressures. It says there are more young people than ever before. About 41% of the global population of 7.7 billion is aged 24 or under. In Africa, 41% are under 15 years old. 41% under 15 years. In Asia and Latin America, where 65% of the world's people live, nearly two-thirds of the world's people, 25% of the people are under age 15. So there's a whole lot of young people out there. This article makes a very interesting point. These young people are growing up in a period of recession and stagnant or falling living standards, and of governments that are implementing austerity programs because of economic problems. And it says, as a result, many current protests are rooted in shared grievances about economic inequality and jobs. In Tunisia, birthplace of the failed 2011 Arab Spring, and more recently in neighboring Algeria, street protests were led by unemployed young people and students angry about price and tax rises, and more broadly, about broken reform promises. Chile and Iraq faced similar upheavals last week. This article says this global phenomenon of unfulfilled youthful aspirations is producing political time bombs. Each month in India, 1 million people turn 18 and can register to vote. In the Middle East and North Africa, an estimated 27 million youngsters will enter the workforce in the next 5 years. Any government, elected or not, that fails to provide jobs, decent wages, and housing faces big trouble. Now, this article makes an even more fascinating point, and sorry if I'm reading a lot here, but listen to this quote. Numbers aside, the younger generations have something else that their elders lacked. They're connected. More people than ever before have access to education. They are healthier. They appear less bound by social conventions and religion. They are mutually aware, and their expectations are higher. That's because, thanks to social media, the ubiquity of English as a common language, and the internet's globalization and democratization of information, younger people from all backgrounds and locations are more open to alternative life choices, more attuned to universal rights and norms, such as free speech or a living wage, and less prepared to accept their denial. So this is a very interesting confluence of trends. You know, if you look at history overall, you have a lot of people who have been submitting to governments and accepting the kinds of corruption and the kinds of problems that you're seeing today, at least as bad as the ones that are happening today. People have been accepting these for thousands of years on a mass scale. I think people just kind of accepted that as the flawed condition of humanity. You know, if you have a government, it's going to have problems. At least it's preferable to anarchy. But today, people's expectations are far higher, even as their standard of living is much higher than it has been for millions of people throughout history. People are still upset because, well, there are others who have even more. The reality is that inequality is endemic in the human experience. It's always existed among every people in every generation throughout human history. But more and more, inequality is causing people who are, by historical comparisons, very well off to become dissatisfied and angry. This Washington Post article makes a similar point. It says, Hong Kong and Egypt, Chile and Lebanon have two things in common: pervasive social media and a rising generation of discontented youth who are masters of it. The combination of the two has changed the balance of power between government and society in both democratic and authoritarian states. The Washington Post says Chile's protests began not with unions or opposition parties, but with middle and high school students who used social media to call on riders to jump subway turnstiles in protest of a fare hike. Similarly, Lebanon's unrest began with young people outraged over attacks on phone calls made on WhatsApp. In Egypt, thousands of mostly young male soccer fans took to the streets of Cairo in response to a call from a previously unknown businessman who posted videos on YouTube denouncing corruption. This had never happened before. Egypt has a lot of opposition, but as this article says, this was an entirely new channel of discontent. In Hong Kong, this article says, activists coordinate over secure apps such as Telegram. They used another app to identify and avoid police deployments before Apple pulled the tool under pressure from Beijing. As elsewhere, the backbone of the movement is young people, including teenagers. This is a motivated generation pushing for dramatic change in the political status quo. In that sense, the youth of 2019 are a little like those of 1968. Their command of new communications technologies makes it easy for them to attract followers, circumvent the usual channels of public debate, and blindside governments. They are able to mobilize large numbers on small issues such as fare increases and tap into general discontent that otherwise might have remained unexpressed. So these technologies and the ways that young people in particular are using them are disrupting our world in ways that we could not have foreseen when these technologies were released. You know, there was no way of telling how big of an impact this was going to have on society. And really, as long as these technologies are around, it's hard to see this trend reversing. You do have governments taking severe, draconian steps to shut these down. They're using force to crush their opposition and to silence these technologies. In China in particular, you see them using measures straight out of George Orwell's 1984. It's very creepy the way that they're using power to monitor their people and take control of their people. And yet here in Hong Kong, you see these protesters that are still using technologies in extremely smart, extremely savvy ways. These technologies can be very difficult to contain once they've escaped from the box. But these really are the beginnings of a new era of political upheaval. And there are plenty of people who are looking at what's happening here and applauding it. And, you know, it is easy in some cases to root for courageous people who are rising up against genuine tyranny. But this Guardian article says perhaps these protests will one day merge into a joined up global revolt against injustice, inequality, environmental ruin, and oppressive powers that be. And I think this writer thinks that would be a great thing. But history does not have a lot of good to say about the wisdom of the mob. A global revolt against injustice and inequality. That would be based on some fundamentally dangerous assumptions. What is justice? What is equality? Everyone has different ideas of what that should look like. And the efforts to implement those different ideas throughout history, time and time again, have produced greater injustice, greater inequality. This is the concluding paragraph of this Guardian article. Meanwhile, spare a thought for a different type of protest, the one you never hear about, and what that may entail. The stifling silence that hangs over North Korea's Gulag, China's Xinjiang and Tibet regions, and dark hidden places inside Syria, Eritrea, Iran, and Azerbaijan could yet descend on us all. What helps protect us is the noisy, life-affirming dissent of the young. So these protests, according to this Guardian author, are what is meant to protect us. This is a sentiment that you see expressed with greater and greater frequency. Adults, intellectuals who talk about just the inherent wisdom of youthful anger and youthful protest and so on. But this is obviously a very complicated trend because you're talking about people in nations all over the world, different circumstances, but you can see some similarities with what's happening in the United States and Britain as angry, discontented young people see problems and they don't feel bound to submit to any authority and they rebel, they demand changes, they get a certain rush from the headiness of revolution. More and more of them have no grounding in family, no positive mentors, nobody to teach them. They're not learning history. They have no perspective. In some cases, they're manufacturing grievances or they're being taught and trained to be angry and discontent. There's no continuity. There's no respect for institutions. Everyone in authority is mistrusted. Everyone who has privilege is considered corrupt and illegitimate. More and more people lack the moral underpinning of sound religion. They live in a godless, amoral universe. And all of this is unquestionably fertile soil for the devil to stir up dissatisfaction and anger and rage, to stir up out-of-control emotions. Mr. Stephen Flory brought this out in his program on Monday, how this really is evidence of Satan being cast down in our day. This is just one example of why the study of history is so invaluable. History is littered with example after example of people standing up and defying the existing order because of injustice and inequality, and people wanting to destroy the status quo. And in case after case, they were superb at identifying the problems with the current system. But where people have failed time after time after time is, what do you replace it with? Can you actually replace the current system with something better? Mobs and mass movements are very good at destruction. but they have a dismal track record of building anything. Revolutionaries know exactly what they hate, but creating workable solutions, that's a lot more difficult. It's a lot more challenging. G.K. Chesterton said, "The reformer is always right about what is wrong. He is also usually wrong about what is right." Will Durant, the great historian, wrote this in his book, The Lessons of History. Will and Ariel Durant. Does history justify revolutions? This is an old debate, he says. And he gives several examples of historical figures who took the route of radical change, and then others who were defending patient and orderly reform, or they were trying to have a greater continuity as they were making changes. And Durant says, in some cases, outworn and inflexible institutions seem to require violent overthrow, as in Russia in 1917. But in most instances, the effects achieved by the revolution would apparently have come without it through the gradual compulsion of economic developments. America would have become the dominant factor in the English-speaking world without any revolution. The French Revolution replaced the land-owning aristocracy with the money-controlling business class as a ruling power, but a similar result occurred in 19th century England without bloodshed and without disturbing the public peace. To break sharply with the past is to court the madness that may follow the shock of sudden blows or mutilations. So this is a man who for decades has studied the lessons of history that have been taught over and over again all over the world through millennia of human existence. And he says that there is a lot to be said about the problems that come from breaking sharply with the past, that it courts madness. He says, as the sanity of the individual lies in the continuity of his memories, so the sanity of a group lies in the continuity of its traditions. In either case, a break in the chain invites a neurotic reaction, as in the Paris massacres of September 1792. Now, the fact is, there are major problems in the world, in every nation. This is Satan's world. The Bible is clear on that point. Many of these protesters are reacting against legitimate problems. But it's a mistake to assume that whatever may fill the void will be an improvement. These protesters are mistaken to think that the violence of resistance is virtuous. They're mistaken to think that the results that it brings will be worth the cost, if they're thinking that far ahead at all. Durant makes this observation from history. He says, violent revolutions do not so much redistribute wealth as destroy it. There may be a redivision of the land, but the natural inequality of men soon recreates an inequality of possessions and privileges and raises to power a new minority with essentially the same instincts as in the old. These upheavals that we're seeing will not lead to anything good. In historical example after example, it actually leads to greater tyranny. Anarchy is insufferable, and people get their fill of it very quickly, and someone steps in and establishes order, often at even higher cost and greater suffering. The Bible has a lot to say about the conditions that are about to prevail in this world. We're about to see a time of tribulation and suffering worse than any in human history. And the instability rolling through country after country today augurs far more serious troubles to come.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Wildfires in California are leaving behind staggering devastation, as we will hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
California is burning. The state's governor, Gavin Newsom, delivered an address on Sunday about an emergency that he declared due to numerous wildfires that are blazing through the state.
This challenging moment in our history with, I'm cautious when I say this, but near historic wind event at a scale and scope the likes of which we haven't seen in some time. That precipitated today with a new statewide emergency declaration, because 43 counties now are impacted by red flag warnings and by these severe weather conditions. We've been battling fires all up and down the state now for close to a week, from San Diego, two major fires now.
Governor Newsom then went on to list the various blazes now raging. He discussed fires in Grass Valley and Mount Diablo, and one in Contra Costa, and another in Ukiah. And he talked about the Tick Fire near Santa Clarita, which has been mostly contained in the last couple of days by the efforts of 1,000 firefighters. But for dozens of residents, it's too late. The damage has been done, and their homes were destroyed and burned to ashes. And then most of the governor's attention from there was put on the most destructive fire of all, the Kincade Blaze in Sonoma County. This fire has already burned more than 66,000 acres, and winds over the weekend reached almost 100 miles per hour, while the relative humidity dropped. Combined with the Kincade's blazes that were already raging, this created conditions like a blowtorch, and made the fire spread at unbelievable speeds. Ross Hull, a meteorologist for Global News, explained yesterday how these various factors combined into a perfect storm.
We're talking hurricane force winds, and wind just throws oxygen onto a fire, you know, and when you have dry conditions and you have the low relative humidity and you have these strong winds moving in, you have the right recipe for disaster.
The disaster this has unleashed is truly staggering. At certain times, the Kincade Fire has grown at a rate of one football field every 3 seconds, and almost 200,000 people have been displaced by its devastation so far. This includes residents of Santa Rosa and tourists and homeowners around the wine capital of Healdsburg, where the historic Soda Rock Winery was burned to ashes. The evacuation zone also included two hospitals. Both had to promptly shut down and send their hundreds of patients to other facilities. It all added up to what the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office said was the largest evacuation that any in their offices can remember. Some 3,000 firefighters are battling the Kincade, but it's only 5% contained, down from 10% a few days ago. And officials say the best-case scenario is that the fire will be completely extinguished by November 7th. Meanwhile, on Monday, as the Kincade Fire and the others were blazing, a new fire broke out on the west side of the 405 freeway. This is near the famous Sherman Oaks neighborhood that's known for its celebrities and multi-million dollar homes. This is called the Getty Fire, and it has scorched many of those houses and properties, and it has caused the evacuation of many of the area's celebrities and other affluent residents. Altogether, there are 17 different fires actively burning in California right now. And the photos coming out of the affected areas are devastating. Some of the most iconic images show a massive plume of smoke hanging over the San Francisco Bay. This provides a visual representation of how millions of Californians are feeling, darkened and confused. The carnage is particularly agonizing for those in the regions that were still just recovering from devastating wildfires that swept through in 2017 and 2018. People across the Golden State are also enduring widespread controlled power outages. Altogether, around 2.7 million Californians are losing their electricity as the fires rage through the state and as power companies try to prevent their lines and equipment from igniting new blazes in the windy and dry conditions. Millions are sitting in the dark, wondering when they'll have their power restored. Thousands of evacuees are struggling to find shelter, wondering if and when they can return home. And many of those who have lost their homes and businesses are struggling to hold on to any hope. Oscar Mancillas, a resident of Sylmar, told AFP last week that many Californians are baffled by the destruction that seems to be pounding the state with increasing intensity, not just from back-to-back fires, but also earthquakes.
That seems to be the new normal in California. I mean, the vegetation is so dry, and I think that's probably, we kind of got lucky. It could have been worse because the vegetation was so short. Even though it was dry, it was short. It didn't really grow back from the last fire. You have to be California, earthquake ready. You have to be fire ready. For those of us that have a family, it's a little daunting sometimes.
So the current wildfires are just the latest disaster to hit California. These kinds of events strike so frequently, they have now become the new normal, as Mr. Mancillas said. For decades, one disaster after another has slammed the Golden State, and the Trumpet has been keeping a careful watch on this trend since the early 1990s. Back in December of 1993, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, quote, "One disaster after another is striking California. These deadly disasters are repeatedly labeled the worst ever. With all the disasters that have struck California in the past few years, it's as if the state is under a curse." End quote. Then, after almost 15 more years of California being hit by more and more calamities, Mr. Flurry wrote on the topic again. On October 24th of 2007, he wrote an article titled, "California Disasters Continue. Why?" And this article digs into the Bible to show that California actually is being cursed. Mr. Flurry points to the 28th chapter in the biblical book of Deuteronomy. This passage is addressing Israel in the end time, which means mainly the present-day nations of America and Britain, and it explains that if they obey God, they will be blessed, and if they reject Him and His law, they will be cursed. Verse 15 says, quote, "If you will not hearken unto the voice of the Eternal your God to observe, to do all his commandments and his statutes, then all these curses shall come upon you." And then in verses 16 through 20, it enumerates several specific curses, saying, quote, "Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field. Cursed shall be your basket and your store. Cursed shall be the fruit of your land, the increase of your oxen, and the flocks of your sheep, because of the wickedness of your doings, whereby you have forsaken me." The Trumpet.com's managing editor, Mr. Brad McDonald, wrote about this passage in a January 2018 article, saying, quote, "That prophecy applies to America and Britain and the British Commonwealth in general, but it resonates especially well with the recent history of the state of California. In its heyday, California was the epitome of American agricultural wealth and prosperity. California overflowed with fruit. It was America's breadbasket, the nation's most important field, basket, and store. Over the past three decades, through drought, floods, scorching heat, and wildfires, these vital facets of American power and prosperity have been greatly ruined. California's curse has been America's curse." End quote. Returning to Mr. Flurry's 2007 article, he explains that the main reason California in particular is seeing these prophesied curses come upon it is not just because of the state's lawless and perverse anti-God culture, but also because of California's history with God and His church. The Worldwide Church of God was headquartered in Pasadena, California, for many years, but in 1979, the state's attorney general launched a massive lawsuit against the church. Mr. Flurry explains that this makes California the only U.S. state that has ever directly attacked the Church of God, and he wrote, quote, "Actually, it attacked a lot more than that. California really attacked the living God." End quote. So California has an astounding amount of history with God and His church, far more than any other state, and it began as a special and a wonderful opportunity for the state, but it ended with California openly rejecting and attacking the living God. And Mr. Fleury explains that this is at the heart of the reason why California is suffering ongoing wildfires and so many other catastrophes. His article concludes with these words: California is only the beginning. The sooner we repent, the sooner the curses will end.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. You know, the quote that you read where the person was saying, in California, you've got to be prepared for anything. You've got to be braced for earthquakes. You've got to be braced for fires. It is amazing how many different problems have happened there. There's been a lot of government corruption, a lot of financial mismanagement, water resources that have been misused, and problems with drought and these wildfires. You had the individual who was talking about the power losses that are taking place in that state. And it seems like with the power losses, that's something that it's almost like the kind of thing that you would expect in a third world nation, where you have power that's being directed to this place and not that, in order to keep up with demand or in order to protect aging infrastructure, that type of thing. Maybe you could just talk a little bit more about that and how the people in California are being hit kind of from all sides in that.
Sure, yeah. I think that's a great angle to bring out. We often hear that if California were a separate country, it would have something like the world's seventh strongest economy. So it's supposedly this prosperous place that has quite an impressive GDP, but yet their power lines and power equipment are apparently so unreliable and old and just haven't been updated in so long that they can't trust it to avoid sparking all of these catastrophic blazes. So it is 2.7 million residents that are suffering these rolling blackouts, and sometimes it's hospitals that are affected and people who are utterly dependent on electricity for their businesses and any number of things. So it really does remind you of kind of a third world nation, and it just makes you wonder, how could a place this prosperous also be suffering these kinds of calamities?
I appreciate you bringing out the point about that Gerald Fleury made. I think it was back in the early 90s when there were some of these disasters that were besieging California. I think this is one of those things that we talk about with some frequency, that someone who's encountering this information for the first time might find difficult to understand how there could be a link between obscure court case in the middle of the 70s and what we're seeing in the state today. But, you know, the more you see these kinds of events happening on the scale that you're seeing in California, you can't help but go back to those statements by the Trumpet's editor-in-chief here almost, 30 years ago, practically, where he said, this is what we can expect to happen based on the attack that California waged, as a government against God's church. And I think anyone who's watching what's happening in California, anyone has to recognize that that state is suffering curses on a scale that you just don't see elsewhere. And it does cause you to want to look at those statements from Gerald Fleury in a different light, just based on the fact that it has unfolded the way that he said that it would.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think when he first wrote about that in the early 90s, it might have been difficult to believe that the state was being specifically cursed. But now, after three decades of seeing these nonstop disasters, whether it's earthquakes, wildfires, droughts, flooding, and then all kinds of financial disasters on top of that, and societal issues like you wouldn't believe, it really vindicates everything that he wrote there in the early 90s.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We've been talking to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about California's wildfires and other disasters. We'll put a link to that reprint article by Gerald Fleury on the show notes for the program, California Disasters Continue, Why? You can also check out Jeremiah's article about this subject on thetrumpet.com. That should be up soon. Thanks so much for your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The political crisis in Germany got a bit more complicated this past weekend as results came in from a state election that jeopardizes the nation's already shaky government. We'll learn about it in this report from Daniel DeSanto.
The German state of Thuringia held its state elections on October 27, this past Sunday. And the results were another demonstration of people voting for fringe parties. People fleeing over to the fringe and absolutely abandoning established parties. This included Angela Merkel's party, which took huge hits. Meanwhile, the far left and the far right both gained in what some news sources called a historic victory. First place went to Germany's Left Party. The Left Party has been strong in this area for a long time, but recently it's gained a status as the strongest party in all of Thuringia, in this state which just held its election. It's never been the strongest party in any state before. Not far behind it, in second, was the Alternative for Germany, the AfD, which held 23.4% of the vote. And this was higher than Merkel's own party, the CDU. The CDU came in at only 21.8. This is the first time, of course, that the left has gained so much, but also it's another victory for AfD, which has been coming in first and second place in many state elections in Germany recently. Together, the far right and the far left took more than half of the vote. They took 54.4% of the vote in this German state. So what does this mean for Merkel? What does this mean for the German state of Thuringia? Politico on the 25th of October had an article headlined Germany's Grand Coalition on the Brink Once More. In it, it said, quote, from its beginning in early 2018, the tie-up between the country's two largest political groups, Angela Merkel's center-right bloc, which is the CDU, and the Social Democrats, the SPD, faced one plague after another, from disastrous election results to backstabbing to leadership turmoil. So Angela Merkel has been having trouble keeping the SPD, or the Social Democrats, allied with her. They've already been feeling that their allegiance to the party is hurting their popularity. This has been compounded by failures in elections. And this latest failure, in which the Social Democrats slipped from 12%, around 12% in 2014, down to all the way to 8% this year, is just adding to that feeling that the SPD should separate from Merkel's coalition, from Merkel's party. And if they do, this would bring down Merkel's government. So we could see an end to Merkel's government sooner even than in 2021, when it's supposed to end. In Thuringia itself, forming a coalition now is going to be extremely difficult. Previously, the Left Party, the Social Democrats, and the Green Party all ruled together. Previously, this is the coalition that was ruling the state. Now, however, this has become impossible because they don't have enough seats to form a government. One option is to bring in the pro-business FDP party. However, the leader of that party has vowed to not work with either the Left Party or the AfD, as he says that both these parties want a fundamental change to German society, which he cannot support. The only other practical option would be to bring in Merkel's CDU. But again, the SPD doesn't want this either. Neither does the Left Party, because it's seen as hurting their popularity. The CDU, Merkel's party, has declined precipitously in this state, and allying with them would only hurt the popularity of these other parties. Werner Patzelt is a political scientist and commentator based in Dresden, and he spoke to The Local, and he made some observations on the perilous state of the coalition in this German state in this election. He said, quote, the AfD in Thuringia is the most radical part of the AfD throughout Germany. So many would have expected that all the arguments claiming this is a party of racists, nationalists, and even led by a fascist, as some accuse, said all those arguments should have dissuaded people from voting for this party, but it didn't. He says this is one more indicator of how much political power is behind the AfD. Concerningly, he also observed that, quote, the last time we saw something of this kind in Germany was in the Weimar Republic, when political life was polarized between the communists and the National Socialists. So in other words, he's comparing the current condition of politics in this German state to the time just before World War II, when people were divided between the Nazis and the communists. So this is a major upset for politics, both in this state of Thuringia and also in Germany, and for Merkel's party. Now, German news source Deutsche Welle called this election historic for both parties, and it said the populist AfD in Thuringia is led by Joran Hocke, who often draws attention to himself with firebrand statements. Now, this man, Hocke, has also been accused of being a fascist, of being a supporter of Nazis. AfD said that Hocke has even called the Holocaust Memorial in Germany a, quote, memorial of shame, and called for a, quote, reversal in Germany's culture of remembrance. So what does all of this mean for Germany? We know that it looks like Merkel might be out sooner than expected. We know that people are going over to radical fringe parties, which before wouldn't have even been touchable. They wouldn't have had a following. But today, they are growing in amazing ways. Ways that are great for their own party, but very concerning for German society. So what is going on in Germany? Well, as our longtime readers know, the Trumpet has warned for many years that a weak German government could provide ideal conditions for a strong man to come in and seize control. He could easily take advantage of a crisis of division of a weak coalition. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has even said in a July 2010 Kiev David program that this strong leader could, quote, take advantage of a weak coalition to get into power. In our booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, which you can find on the Trumpet website, Mr. Fleury also wrote, quote, we need to watch the European Union for a man stepping in and seizing control of the entity through flatteries. He is going to hijack the EU. Politics in Europe are going to shift dramatically to the right. And this is what we've been seeing in German state elections. Now, how did our editor-in-chief know about this trend long before the refugee crisis even started back in 2010? Well, of course, all of our forecasts are based on Bible prophecy. Daniel 11:21 says the strong leader, quote, shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Daniel 8:23 as well describes this man as, quote, a king of fierce countenance. Mr. Fleury fully explains all of this in our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, which you can also read, download, or order on the Trumpet website. He says, quote, this soon coming ruler could literally be called a king. Even if he is not, the Bible gives him that label. And when the Bible talks about a king, in most cases, it's saying that this is not a democratic government. So continue to watch the EU and watch Germany. As election upsets continue to weaken Merkel's coalition, this prophecy of a strong German leader is coming closer and closer to becoming reality. If you really want to understand the fulfillment of this prophecy, how it will change not only Germany, not only Europe, but really the entire world, very shortly, you can order a free copy of A Strong German Leader is Imminent by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and you can find that on our website.
Thank you for that, Daniel. It is so fascinating to see just how the people of Germany are moving to the fringes, showing just how discontented they are with politics as they stand, where they're willing to embrace these parties that up until quite recently would have been considered pretty well untouchable.
Yes, well, especially for the AfD. In this case, the AfD was formed at a time when the refugee crisis was just beginning. At that time, Merkel looked a lot more stable. People thought that she would be ruling for a long, long time. It didn't look like there'd be anything that major, which would bring down her government. And then we look at the AfD today. They're surging into second place, into first place in some cases. And this has all changed because of mainly because of the refugee crisis.
Mm-hmm.
This is a result of people flooding into Europe and Europe's core values, people's core values, being challenged in a way that they haven't ever been before.
Well, you make a very good point that when you see people who are that discontented, that they are willing to embrace, say, these political solutions that they would have considered impossible just a short time before, that you can see how these conditions are setting Germany up and other European nations up to embrace a leader who comes in and proposes a solution that a lot of people can get behind, that say they would not have done just a short time before. But you see the kind of instability that Merkel's government is facing, and really all of this is setting Germany up to fulfill those prophecies that we've been talking about for quite a few years now, and even Herbert W. Armstrong for decades before that. We appreciate that very much, Daniel. We've been talking to trumpet writer Daniel DeSanto about German elections from this past weekend. You can read his article about this subject on thetrumpet.com. The title is Radical Parties Victorious in German State Election. Thanks very much for your time, Daniel.
Thank you.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Daniel DeSanto. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Alfred North Whitehead. Not ignorance, but ignorance of ignorance is the death of knowledge. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.